Coon Review puts Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CoenReview. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@coenreview.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 2nd of June 2023 from the news section. Angela Constance in talks with judiciary on young people's sentencing. This article is written by Steph Braun. Justice Secretary Angela Constance has met with a senior member of Scotland's judiciary over guidelines on the sentencing of young people. First Minister Humza Yousaf said Constance had met very recently with Lady Dorrian, the Lord Justice Clerk and Chair of the Scottish Sentencing Council. Discussions took place about the Council's plans to keep sentencing guidelines under review, the First Minister added. It came as he was challenged in the wake of public concern about the leniency of sentencing in the case of Sean Hogg, who was given a community payback order for raping a 13-year-old girl because he was 17 at the time of the offence. His sentence has now been appealed by the Crown on the basis it was unduly lenient. Labour's Pauline McNeill also said a discount had been applied in the case of Rhys Bennett, 23, who was jailed for at least 24 years for murdering mother of two, Jill Barclay, who he raped and set alight. McNeill said sentencing guidelines, which apply to offenders under the age of 25, mean there was a reduction in the sentence of 4 years. Raising the issue of First Minister's questions, she asked Yousaf, when it comes to horrific crimes as serious as rape and murder, does the First Minister believe there should be a reduced sentence for under 25s? Yousaf responded, for me, it is absolutely right the decisions on sentencing are for the independent judiciary. But it must always be the case, even in those cases where there are particularly heinous crimes, that sentencing is always a matter for independent judiciary and should be free from any political interference whatsoever. He told McNeill that when he was Justice Secretary, he had seen a near final draft of the guidelines, adding the Sentencing Council had taken an evidence-led, collaborative approach when developing them. There was a mountain of evidence which helped produce them, the First Minister added, noting also that they had been subject to public consultation. Yousaf told MSPs, it should be noted the position in the guidelines is that custody is still an option for sentencing young people, and it is, of course, completely right this option remains available to the court in any given case. The Cabinet Secretary for Justice and Home Affairs, Angela Constance, met very recently with Lady Dorrian to discuss how the Council plans to keep these guidelines under review. The guidelines, which came into force in January 2022, state that rehabilitation should be a primary consideration when sentencing someone under the age of 25. And that article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday the 2nd of June 2023, from the politics section. MSP Mercedes Villalba bids to limit land super rich can own in Scotland. This article is written by Xander Eliards. An MSP will bid to bring in a new law which would cap the amount of Scottish land the super-rich can own. Mercedes Villalba, who represents Labour on the North East list, has unveiled plans to put a presumed limit of 500 hectares, 5 square kilometres, on how much land a person can own, sell or transfer without triggering a public interest test. The MSP said that currently just 432 landowners own 50% of all Scotland's privately owned rural land. Villalba further said that the 500 hectare limit meant crofters, the vast majority of farmers, allotment holders and other small-scale landowners will not be affected. Danish billionaire Anders Holch Poulsen, Scotland's largest private landowner, owns some 89,500 hectares. Villalba argued that the extraordinarily high concentration of land in the hands of so few is severely limiting access to affordable homes, stifling job creation, increasing land prices and harming the environment. The Community Land Scotland annual conference, which is taking place on Skye from June the 2nd to the 3rd, will see Villalba announce her proposals. She will then launch her members' bill, the Land Ownership and Public Interest Scotland Bill, on June the 7th. A consultation will run for 14 weeks after that. Separately, Villalba has put a motion into the Scottish Parliament asking MSPs to note that there is a need for stronger action to disrupt the concentration of land ownership in Scotland. It has achieved cross-party support, including from SNP MSP John Mason and Ruth Maguire and Green MSP Mark Ruskell. The motion, which does not explicitly mention the Land Justice Bill, but deals with similar themes, has been placed in order to allow a debate on the topic soon after the consultation opens. Last year, the Scottish Government launched its own consultation on land reform, but Villalba called it timid, for only looking to apply to purchases above 3,000 hectares. The MSP said, "The extraordinary high concentration of so much land in the hands of so few is the foundation of the inequality that has blighted Scotland for centuries. The super-rich are hoarding land that should be run by community representatives and cooperatives for the benefit of everyone." She added, "This Land Justice Bill is an opportunity for Scotland to end the hugely iniquitous and archaic land ownership arrangements that date back to medieval times." Humza Yousaf's SNP and the Scottish Greens must work with Labour to deliver meaningful land justice rather than join with the Tories to protect the privilege of the wealthy. The proposal for Land Ownership and Public Interest Scotland Bill reads, "A proposal for a bill to address the centuries-old concentrated pattern of land ownership in Scotland and to restore land for the many by introducing a presumed limit of 500 hectares on individual sales or transfers of land and on the aggregate amount of land any person can own, and by strengthening the regulation of Scotland's land market by making land transfers over the 500 hectare limit subject to a public interest test." In 2013, in a briefing to the House of Commons Scottish Affairs Committee, it was reported that just 432 landowners own 50% of all Scotland's privately owned land. There is no more current figure available, but there is no indication that there has been a significant shift in this pattern of ownership. Increasing transparency on this is urgent if concerns over patterns of land ownership are to be discussed openly. Commonweal cites research by Scottish Land and Estates showing that Scotland's private shooting estates create just 2,640 jobs, including indirect jobs, with an average income of £11,401, below minimum wage levels. Around a seventh of Scotland's rural land area is used for grouse shooting. The Scottish Land Commission's 2022 market report showed land value jumped 61% in 2021 alone, in part due to the increasing purchase of Scottish land for carbon credit schemes. That article was written by Zander Eliards. This is from The National on Friday the 2nd of June 2023, from the news section. Rent cap set to be extended for final 6 months until March 2024. This article is written by Steph Braun. A rent cap and ban on evictions looks set to be extended for a further 6 months in an effort to protect private tenants during the cost of living crisis. Tenants' Rights Minister, Patrick Harvey, has confirmed proposals to keep the Cost of Living Tenant Protection Act measures in place until the end of March at the latest. Current legislation is due to expire at the end of September. This would mean most in-tenancy private rent increases would continue to be capped at 3%, while enforcement of evictions would continue to be paused for 6 months for most tenants. Increased damages for unlawful evictions of up to 36 months' worth of rent would continue to be applicable. Private landlords could apply for rent increases of up to 6% to help cover certain increases in costs in a specified time period where these costs can be evidenced. Parliament is still to vote on the proposed extension. Harvey clarified if Parliament did vote for it, this would be the final period the legislation would be in force. Greens MSP Harvey said, "As the cost of living crisis continues, these measures are giving important support to tenants, providing them with much needed stability in their housing costs and additional eviction protections." As the social housing sector have agreed their rents in consultation with their tenants, the focus of this temporary legislation is on providing private renters with similar protection. We know some landlords are impacted by rising costs too. The option of increasing rents by 6% in specified circumstances ensures landlords who may be impacted by the cost of living crisis can recover some increased costs associated with their let property. The final date of March 31st, 2024 would be as long as the rent cap and eviction protections could run, if approved by Parliament. The necessity of these measures is being kept under review, and we will continue to assess whether they remain justified, balanced and proportionate, based on the financial pressures rented households and landlords are facing. We are also looking at how to transition out of the emergency measures, and we continue to listen to and work hard with stakeholders to develop and deliver rental sector reform. Social rented sector tenants are protected by the voluntary agreement reached with social landlords on below inflation rent increases for this financial year. Aditi Jengar, Secretary of Tenants Union Living Rent, said, "This announcement provides a huge relief for private tenants. Inflation might have decreased, but working people are still struggling to make ends meet. Rents are still sky high, and food bills and energy bills are continuing to push too many people into poverty. And to ensure that there is a smooth transition and no cliff edge for tenants when the cap runs out by March 2024, the government needs to have introduced rent controls that bring down rents, bring up quality standards, and are tied to the property, not the tenancy. Until then, these emergency protections will go a long way in ensuring that tenants are able to stay in their homes and not face sky-high rent increases as the cost of living continues to hit hard." That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday the 2nd of June 2023, from the news section. Water scarcity alert issued after dry spring in Scotland. This article is written by Jane McLeod. Parts of Scotland are in a state of water scarcity, while southern England has seen above average rainfall, according to Met Office analysis. Spring has seen slightly above average rainfall across the UK as a whole, but this masks strong regional differences. The Scottish Environment Protection Agency, SEPA, has announced a water scarcity alert for many parts of the Northern Highlands and the Outer Hebrides, as well as parts of the Scottish borders. A moderate scarcity alert is in place around Loch Maree, one step away from the most serious category, with almost every other Scottish region in an early warning state. Though March was very wet in England, with Cambridge, Dorset and Norfolk seeing above average spring rainfall, it's the driest spring in northern Scotland since 2018. Stephen Maguire of the Water Scarcity Team at SEPA said, "Spring and summer are crucial times of year for water demand, and SEPA started regularly reporting on water scarcity at the end of April. Initially, there were early warnings of water scarcity in the north and west of Scotland, with rainfall and river flows low for the time of year. But in recent weeks, we've experienced more rapidly drying conditions, and river levels are now very low across much of Scotland. We have already issued alerts for water scarcity in the northwest and south central areas, and with little rain in the immediate forecast, we expect the situation to escalate quickly and extend across a much wider area in the coming weeks. SEPA will continue to report weekly on the emerging situation." Across the UK, the mean average temperature for the spring was 8.36 centigrade, only slightly above the long-term average between 1991 and 2020, though this season has been one of three since 2000 when the warmest day of the year so far has exceeded 25 degrees centigrade on May the 29th or later. The warmest locations for mean temperature were across Scotland, Northern England and Northern Ireland, with some locations seeing 1.4 degrees centigrade above the average for 1991 to 2020. Lancashire was the sunniest county relative to the average across the spring period from March to May, while Northern Ireland saw the greatest difference to normal temperatures, with it being 0.76 degrees centigrade above average. In May, Manchester had only 39% of its average rainfall for the month, making it the driest area of England. Across the UK, only 55% of expected rainfall was recorded in May, making it one of the driest Mays in recent times, the Met Office said, though the one in 2020 was even drier. Orkney saw the least amount of sunshine hours in May, with the 95 figure at half of the expected. Cornwall saw the most for May with 289.5 hours, which is 137% of the average. Mike Kendon of the Met Office's National Climate Information Centre said, "Although mean temperature for May has been above average, it is notable that we haven't seen any particularly significant peaks of above average temperature, especially during the second half of the month." That article was written by Jane McLeod.
From the National, Monday the 5th of June 2023, from the Politics section, exclusive, BBC Scotland's agenda exposed by Wales Comparison Academic Claims, by report by Xander Eliards. BBC Scotland politicises public services to attack the SNP government in a way that BBC Wales does not for its own devolved government, according to the conclusions of a report drawn up by a former media professor. Dr. John Robertson, who worked in the University of the West of Scotland's Cultural Industry School until 2016, said he had set out to conduct the research after watching a BBC Scotland broadcast. He told The National, "It occurred to me one day watching BBC Scotland news that just about every story, it could be about policing, education, nursing, at the end of it there would be a statement from the Scottish Government. I thought, is that normal? I wondered if it is the same elsewhere. So I did a month's survey of BBC Wales, and that's a major finding, I think, of this research. BBC Wales don't make that connection. They go to the health board, to the chief of police, to the body director responsible." Robertson ran a 4-week survey from May the 8th to June the 2nd, which saw him gather objective data on 50 measures, including whether any opposition parties were platformed, whether the report suggested the government had been directly responsible for an issue, and whether negative stories mentioned the ruling government, casually or otherwise. he found that opposition parties were platformed in the morning news 4 times on BBC Scotland, but not once on BBC Wales. Robertson said that those numbers were small, but other findings were more statistically significant. Specifically, he pointed to figures which showed that of the 52 negative stories in BBC Scotland over that period, 24 made mention of the government. In Wales, the 47 negative stories about the country saw the government mentioned 13 times. It's a politicising of public services in Scotland that is not happening in Wales, Robertson argued. Nowhere else in Europe would people think that if there's something wrong in a hospital, you go straight to the government. This is a very objective piece of evidence. A lot of research into media bias is very subjective, based on interpretation and so on. But, objectively, BBC Wales did it by a ratio of 1 to 2 with BBC Scotland. Asked if he could comment on why he thought there were so many differences between the Welsh and Scottish arms of the BBC, Robertson said, "Why do I think that is? That's more difficult. That's not something I can prove. I can prove that objective difference in the reporting between BBC Wales and BBC Scotland." The former professor said it would be normal in other parts of the world for state broadcasters to work on behalf of the state. They wouldn't play that game that BBC Scotland plays and pretend to be fair, Robertson said. "I'm a campaigner for independence," he went on. "I think I should be open about that. I think when researchers are not open about what their politics are, it's deceptive. So I hope this strengthens the cause and makes people realise that BBC Scotland has an agenda." In the conclusion of his report, Robertson argues that it presents conclusive confirmation that BBC Scotland operates consistently and frequently to weaken the case for independence by attempting to cast doubt on the ability of the SNP in government to run the country effectively. While working at the University of the West of Scotland, Robertson chaired the Faculty in Research Ethics. He published academic articles on the media, including analysis of press coverage of the Second Iraq War and the value of broadcast news output. During the 2014 referendum campaign, Robertson made headlines with a report claiming Good Morning Scotland had a pro-union bias. The academic said at the time his report suggested the show was balanced and crude in numerical terms, but, in every other respect, unfair to the Yes campaign and favouring the Better Together campaign. Robertson runs a Talking Up Scotland blog, where his research has been previously published and can be read in full. The BBC has been approached for comment. And that article was an exclusive by Xander Eliards. From the National, Monday the 5th of June 2023. From the news section, British Airways, BBC and Boots confirmed data breach and zealous hack. Article by Laura Pollock. The banking and contact details of tens of thousands of employees for major UK companies have been exposed in a cyber attack. British Airways, BA, has revealed all its staff who are paid in the UK have been caught up in a cyber incident, and Boots have also confirmed they have been affected. Thousands of firms are understood to be affected, and UK-based payroll provider Zealous confirmed on Monday that 8 of its clients were among them. It did not name the organisations, however, both BA and Boots have released statements confirming they are amongst those affected. A BBC spokesman confirmed they were also affected by the hack. The airline employs 34,000 people in the UK and Boots has 50,000 staff. It emerged last week with a flaw in a $2.6 billion file transport system, MoveIt, produced by American company Progress Software, had been exploited by Russian cyber criminals. In this incident, the compromised information included contact details, national insurance numbers, and bank details. BA said, "We have been informed that we are one of the companies impacted by Zealous's cybersecurity incident, which occurred via one of their three third-party suppliers called MoveIt." Zealous provides payroll support services to hundreds of companies in the UK, of which we are one. The incident happened because of a newly previously unknown vulnerability in a widely used MoveIt file transfer tool. "We have notified these colleagues our personal information has been compromised to provide support and advice." A Boots spokesperson said, "A global data vulnerability, which affects a third-party software used by one of our payroll and pop providers, including some of our team members' personal details. Our provider assured us that immediate steps were taken to disable the server, and as a priority we have made our team members aware." The BBC spokesman said, "We are aware of a data breach at our third-party supplier, Zealous, and are working closely with them as they urgently investigate the extent of the breach. We take data security extremely seriously and are following the established reporting procedures. Zealous provides payroll services to a large number of major companies, including the NHS and Jaguar Land Rover. The hack has affected 8 of its customers, a source said. Zealous said in its own statement, a large number of companies around the world have been affected by a zero-day vulnerability in Progress Software's MoveIt Transfer product. We can confirm that a small number of our customers have been impacted by this global issue, and we are actively working to support them. All Zealous-owned software is unaffected, and there are no associated incidents or compromises to any other part of our IT estate. Once we became aware of this incident, we took immediate action, disconnecting the server that utilises MoveIt software and engaging in an expert external security incident response team to assist with forensic analysis and ongoing monitoring. And that article was by Laura Pollock. From The National, Monday the 5th of June 2023, Politics. Commons suspended by Speaker before immigration statement. Report by Hamish Morrison. Proceedings in the House of Commons have been suspended after the Home Office gave the opposition insufficient time to prepare a response to a statement on immigration. The Speaker suspended business for 10 minutes on Monday to allow the Shadow Home Secretary time to finish reading a statement from the department. Labour's Yvette Cooper complained that she had become used to the Home Office failing to give her enough time to prepare responses to official statements in the chamber. Speaker Lindsay Hoyle said he had not had enough time to read the statement either. He said, before I come to the statement, can I just say to the Home Secretary, I was going to say to the Shadow Home Secretary, are you happy to continue, or do you want me to suspend to give you time to read it? Shadow Home Secretary Cooper replied, Mr. Speaker, I've only received the statement at 1:30. If it was possible to have a further 10 minutes, that would be appreciated, but I don't want to inconvenience the House. Unfortunately, we have become used to these late statements from the Home Office. Hoyle replied, it was very late coming to me. I've not had the time to look at it. You're not being given sufficient time. And the Home Secretary said, unfortunately, it was ready. It just didn't arrive to our office. And that article was by Hamish Morrison. From The National, Monday the 5th of June 2023, from the news section, exclusive Deputy FM to attend event in Dundee on wellbeing economy, by Adam Robertson. Deputy First Minister Shona Robertson will be amongst those speaking at an event organised by Dundee SNP and the Dundee Independence Group, DAIG, on the importance of the wellbeing economy. The event, titled Pints and Politics, Wellbeing Economy, is due to take place on June the 17th at the Fairfield Community Sports Hub in Dundee from 7pm. Also attending the event will be the CEO and founder of Business for Scotland, Gordon McIntyre, Kemp, who has written extensively on wellbeing economies, including a piece for The National last month. Councillor Siobhan Tolland, who represents Lochee for Dundee City Council, will be attending the event. She said, a wellbeing economy marks a huge change in how we organise our society. A society not for profit, but for people. For that reason, it becomes the driving force of what an independent Scotland can be. An independent Scotland must be a well-being one. This talk sets this in place just before the Independence Convention. According to the Scottish Government's website, making the transition to a well-being economy is a top priority. It goes on, this means building an economy that operates within safe environmental limits and which serves the collective well-being of current and future generations, first and foremost. We previously told how other countries around the world were looking to Scotland and how to prioritise well-being in their approach to the economy. Tickets for the event cost £8 and can be purchased online at eventbrite.com. They can also be purchased by calling 01382 903 210. That's 01382 903 210. Lee Mills of Dundee SNP said he was happy to be working collaboratively with DAIG. This event is for anyone who needs to equip themselves with the knowledge and expertise of what a wellbeing economy can mean for an independent Scotland. DAIG's Alistair Ballantyne added, the wellbeing economy will improve the lives of those most affected by the hardships caused by the current austerity economy. And that article was an exclusive by Adam Robertson. From The National, Monday the 5th of June 2023, from the Lifestyle section, find out the 7 most desirable places to live in Scotland. Article by Steph Braun. New research has revealed the 7 most desirable places to live in Scotland. With the summer almost upon us and sunny weather already here, many people may be looking to make a move to somewhere where they can make the most of the glorious blue skies, especially now working from home is more common. Office space consultancy, freeofficefinder.com, has ranked the most desirable places to live north of the border using the number of views each location received on TikTok. So here they are. 7. Ely, Fife. The scenic spot of Ely in Fife came out as the 7th most desirable spot in Scotland, with its 16th century harbour and sandy bay being top attractions. 6. Gullane, East Lothian. This beautiful seaside town on the Gulf Coast, with stunning award-winning beach, has 293,400 TikTok views. People also enjoy the sight of Gullane on the John Muir Way, a footpath along the coast between Musselburgh and Dunglass. Gullane Golf Club has hosted the Scottish Open, while Muirfield has hosted the Open Championship on several occasions. 5. Killearn, Stirling. The small village of Killearn has come 5th with 393,200 TikTok views. There is plenty to do there, including visiting the Glengoyne Distillery, Loch Lomond and the Trossachs National Park, and the West Highland Way. 4. Isle of Islay. You really can't have a countdown of idyllic spots without including the islands. Islay in Argyllan Butte is home to numerous whisky distilleries, which are the most famous for making some of Scotland's most peaty drams. Bowmoor was founded way back in 1779, while Ardnahoe was established in 2018. There is also plenty of stunning landscapes and wildlife. 3. Craigielachie, Moray. The first place in the top 3 is Craigielachie in Moray with 645,000 TikTok views. Sitting on the confluence of the River Spey and River Fiddish, it is famous for 2 whisky distilleries, as well as sites such as the Craigielachie Bridge. 2. Braemar, Aberdeenshire. With 3,700,000 TikTok views, Braemar comes in 2nd. It is widely known for its stunning scenery surrounded by the Grampian Mountains, with the Cairngorms National Park right on your doorstep. 1. Isle of Mull. According to the research, the Isle of Mull has come out as the most desirable place to live, with 12,400,000 TikTok views. Home to iconic colourful houses in Tobermory as well as unique wildlife, many would say it's deserving of top spot. And that article was by Steph Braun. From The National, Monday the 5th of June 2023, from the news section, Royal Blood breaks silence after swearing at a Dundee big weekend crowd. This article is by multimedia journalist Laura Pollock. Royal Blood singer Mike Kerr has said his sense of humour is dry as MDF after performing at BBC Radio 1's Big Weekend. The rock duo performed on the main stage of the festival in Dundee last Sunday in a swap between pop stars Niall Horan and Lewis Capaldi. As the band came to the end of their performing slot, frontman Kerr berated the audience for their perceived lack of enthusiasm. He has now said he was trying to make light of the situation. The band were subsequently lambasted online for the behaviour. The performance was from the BBC's online coverage, but a video shared by The Rock Revival went viral on Twitter with more than 18 million views and a number of comments. Speaking to Greg James on his Radio 1 breakfast show, Kerr said, "I'm amazed at how that escalated to that kind of size. Walking off from the show, I felt I was being entertaining, in a way of trying to make light of the situation. Perhaps I was doing a performance where I felt a little bit out of place. I expected to be a little bit bemused and maybe confused a few people, but not to that kind of scale. It was pretty wild." Drummer Ben Thatcher said, "It was a moment of madness that has gone out of control, I think. We actually loved the gig. We love playing music and we love doing what we do. So it's been a bit of a mad week to come out of this." Kerr continued, "It was somewhat of a blip on my part because it would have taken me 3 minutes to think, maybe these people don't know who you are. But I wasn't going through that thought process. I was very pumped backstage and I actually really enjoyed playing. I had a great time. The ending to me, I felt like a sort of pro wrestler. I was walking off like some sort of pantomime villain. I didn't feel like I'd done anything morally wrong. I feel like a bit of a wind-up. Honestly, that's kind of how I felt. When James said Kerr was dry in his humour, Kerr agreed, saying he was dry as MDF. He said he had watched the performance back, adding, "When I'm in that zone, it's part of my personality which only exists on stage. I can't find any other context in which I'm that energised. I feel like I look different when I'm on stage. Off stage, I'm very quiet and sort of awkward. That's why I love it, because there's an energy to it. I guess it's very easy to get that sort of swept up in that energy, and honestly, it's quite fun, and I don't mean any offence. My intention is never to alienate anyone or anyone in this way." Asked if he wanted to share a message with the crowd from Dundee, he said, "My message is that I meant no offence. We look forward to coming back, and applause is optional." And that article was by Laura Pollock. From the National, Monday the 5th of June 2023, from the news section, Tory MP Bob Stewart charged with racially aggravated offence. Report by Hamish Morrison. A Conservative MP has been charged with an alleged racially aggravated public order offence, police have confirmed. Bob Stewart, the Tory MP for Beckenham, was charged in connection with an alleged incident said to have taken place outside the Foreign Office's Lancaster House on December the 14th last year, according to the Metropolitan Police. Police opened a case after the complaint from activist Saeed Ahmed Awadi, who says he is living in exile after being tortured in the Gulf state of Bahrain. In a statement, the force said, "Robert Alexander Stewart, 73, a Member of Parliament of Beckenham, Bromley, was charged by postal requisition on Monday, June the 5th with using aggravated or abusive words or behaviour or disorderly behaviour, and the offence was racially aggravated, contrary to section 31(1)(c) and brackets 5 of the Crime and Disorder Act 1998. Using threatening or abusive words and behaviour likely to cause harassment, alarm or distress, contrary to section 5(1)(6) of the Public Order Act 1986. Both offences are alleged to have occurred on Wednesday the 14th of December 2022 in Belgravia, London, SW1. Stewart will appear at Westminster Magistrates Court on Wednesday, July the 5th. It said both charges related to the same incident, and that the second offence is an alternative charge to allow the court discretion on the racial element. And that report was by Hamish Morrison. From the National, Monday the 5th of June 2023, from the Culture section, Lewis Capaldi cancels all shows prior to Glastonbury, by Molly Court. Scottish musician Lewis Capaldi has announced that he is cancelling all remaining shows up until his Glastonbury performance later this month. The Before You Go hitmaker said he is struggling both mentally and physically and is struggling to get to grips with it all. He also says he needs to spend time with friends and family so he can be Lewis from Glasgow for a while. The pop star recently opened up about his mental health struggles during his Netflix documentary titled Lewis Capaldi, How I'm Feeling Now, and was praised for his honesty as fans were able to catch a glimpse into his world. In a full statement published on his Instagram stories today, Lewis said, "Hi everyone, hope you're well. This is a really difficult message, and one that hurts me a lot to have to type, but I'm really sorry to say that I'm going to have to cancel all commitments from now until I play Glastonbury on June the 24th. It's been such an incredible time leading into this new album, and seeing all of the support from everyone has been beyond anything I could ever have dreamed of. That said, the last few months have been full on both mentally and physically. I haven't been home properly since Christmas, and at the moment I'm struggling to get to grips with it all. I need to take a moment to rest and recover, to be able to be at my best and be ready for Glastonbury and all of the other incredible shows coming up so that I'm able to continue doing what I love for a long time to come. I need to take these 3 weeks to be loose from Glasgow for a bit, spend some time with my family and friends and do normal life things that are an important part of me feeling better. I hope everyone understands. I know many of you will have spent money on travels or hotels, which I appreciate more than ever with how difficult things are economically at the moment, so I'm extremely sorry for the impact this will have. The fact you're willing to come out and spend your time, money and love on these shows is beyond comprehension, and I feel incredibly lucky. I'm getting all the help and support I need from the incredible people around me, who I'm so grateful for. I take none of this for granted and can't wait to be back doing it again. All my love, Lewis, X. The announcement means Lewis will miss performances at Capitol Summertime Ball and others. And that article was written by Molly Court.
From the National, Tuesday the 6th of June 2023, from the news section. Douglas Ross condemns drag queen story time as inappropriate, by Ross Hunter. Douglas Ross has condemned a drag queen story time event in Murray as inappropriate for children. An event at Elgin Library, organised by Murray Council, is scheduled to go ahead on Saturday, with teacher and drag artist Miss Lossie Mouth, which is described as a fun and interactive show suitable for children aged 0 to 6. However, Douglas Ross has said that it is common sense that story times for children should not focus on gender and sexual identity. He tweeted, "It's totally inappropriate to hold a show like this for kids under the age of 6. Story time for babies and young kids shouldn't focus on gender or sexual identity. That is common sense, and on behalf of constituents who've contacted me, I've raised this with the council." Last year, a similar event in Dundee was cancelled after the performer said she felt her safety could be at risk after receiving abuse online from people who felt the event wasn't appropriate for children. Murray Council's principal librarian, David Hayden, said the event was planned to celebrate Pride Month. "Our library's teams have fantastic themed displays throughout the year, and Pride is a particular favourite as it livens up our libraries even more. Having Miss Lossie Mouth taking part in story time for our young readers is a great way to promote equality, diversity and inclusion. We are breaking down barriers in so many ways with this initiative, getting our youngsters into libraries, encouraging confidence to be themselves and promoting acceptance. I know a number of wee ones who will be very excited to get to the library to make some noise and join in the fun." Last year, a similar event in Dundee was cancelled after the performer said she felt unsafe after backlash from people online who said it was unsafe for children. This article was by Steph Braun. From the National, Tuesday the 6th of June 2023, from the news section. Scott attempts world record climb of Ben Nevis with 100 kilograms for MND. By Steph Braun. A mountain rescuer will attempt to smash a world record when he climbs Ben Nevis with 100 kilograms on his back. On Wednesday night, David Duer will begin the Mammoth Challenge to raise vital funds for the My Name's Doddy Foundation. The charity helps to fund research into finding a cure for motor neurone disease in memory of Scottish rugby legend Doddy Weir, who died from the condition last year. If Duher completes the climb with what is the equivalent of the weight of a giant panda on his back, he will be the proud holder of a Guinness World Record. So far, the Uddingston man has bagged several Munros with a barbell in his back, including Ben Vorlich with 95 kilograms and Ben Lomond with 75 kilograms, but this will be his toughest challenge yet. Duher, who has raised more than £10,000 for the charity, said, "The pain in my back, neck and shoulders is impossible to ignore and manage. However, I want to symbolise the burden carried by the people who live with MND and their families as much as possible." Reaching the summit of Ben Vorlich at 3,300 feet with nearly 100 kilograms on my back was probably my highlight so far. It was a very challenging day. Duer, who will also celebrate his 38th birthday on Wednesday, has trained 6 days per week, every week for the last 6 months, and has upped his calorie intake beyond 4,000 calories during his training. The dad of two, who has been an active mountain rescue member for several years, will meet his support team at the Ben Nevis Inn at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday before setting off at 7 p.m. He added, "We wanted to climb in the evening to minimise disruption to other hill walkers. My goal is to reach the summit by 7 a.m. With fine weather, it should make for an amazing sunset and sunrise. I am worried about injury, but I've prepared mentally, and I will keep going until the job is done. I want it to be difficult and painful. I've already been emotional during some walks, just because of the pain and exhaustion. But that adds to the magnitude for me, so I'm not afraid to show it. I've received so many lovely messages from families of people diagnosed or whose family have passed away due to MND. That reinforces the reasons for why I'm tackling the task. I'll be thinking about Dottie with every step. It's been a big sacrifice. I'll take a week off to recover once I'm done and maybe start planning a wee holiday when it's all over. Paul Thompson, director of fundraising at My Name's Dottie Foundation, said, "We are blown away by David's efforts. His training alone is unthinkable. We will all be rooting for him and are very proud that Dottie's legacy continues to inspire people to do incredible things and push beyond their limits, all to find a cure for MND. We are very grateful to him and to everyone who has donated." That article was by Steph Braun.
From The National of Tuesday, the 6th of June, 2023, from the comment section, "We need to show carers that Scotland cares every week of the year," by Karen Adam. "This week is Carers Week, and I want to take this moment to recognise and appreciate the tremendous contributions of carers who selflessly dedicate their lives to caring for others. Their tireless efforts often go unnoticed and underappreciated. Being a carer encompasses a multitude of responsibilities and demands. It is a journey that is unique to each individual, shaped by the needs and circumstances of those being cared for. Carers face diverse challenges ranging from physical and emotional strain to financial and social sacrifices. They serve as advocates, nurses, chauffeurs, cooks, cleaners and companions, constantly adapting to the evolving needs of their loved ones. During the day and night, carers provide unwavering support, often sacrificing their own rest and well-being. They undergo a continuous learning process, acquiring knowledge about specific conditions and care requirements to provide the best possible support. The role of a carer demands resilience, compassion, and an unwavering commitment to the well-being of their loved ones. These demands are often too much to bear, but bear they must. I have experienced the challenges and rewards of being a carer throughout my life, from supporting my deaf father to being a single mother to six children, some of whom require additional support. It means, as I remember from my own experience, reaching the limits of my patience and resilience, only to discover that I had a small child covered in feces, leaving no time for self-pity. Or getting to bed at almost 3 a.m. and setting an alarm for 6 a.m., but never needing the alarm because somebody will have a need to be taken care of before then. Being a carer meant relinquishing the notion of a normal life as the responsibilities and demands took precedence. However, the experience of being a carer also instilled in me a passion for politics, urging me to advocate for the often unseen and unheard individuals within the corridors of power. I was often let down, but mostly it was the loved one I was advocating for who were let down the most. I see it now reflected in my casework every single week, and I wish I had the time to sit down and chat with all these individuals. They so need it. Validation is vital, but action is more so. While celebrating the invaluable role of carers, it is also important to acknowledge the gender imbalance within this realm, where women predominantly shoulder the burden of unpaid care work. This gender disparity hinders women's career progression, financial independence, and overall gender equality. And by acknowledging the gender imbalance, we can raise awareness about the need for greater support and recognition for unpaid carers, particularly women. Our appreciation for carers should extend beyond a week-long celebration. We must support systemic changes that address the challenges they face on a daily basis. It is important to advocate for policies that provide financial assistance, respite care, and accessible support services, empowering carers to fulfil their role more effectively while maintaining their own well-being. It is crucial to also advocate for policies and initiatives that promote gender equality. I want the topic of care and carers to take up space in political areas and to have the calls heard directly. Therefore, I was honoured and jumped at the chance to be asked to sponsor an event in the Scottish Parliament which was focused on a campaign headed by Oxfam. It was an eye-opening evening with some sobering testimonies from an array of different people with varying aspects in and around care. Oxfam, along with another 55 organisations, are calling for a dedicated new national outcome to fully value and invest in those experiencing care and all those providing it, as well as a robust set of national indicators to track progress. They know it won't be a silver bullet nor a substitute for immediate action to better value and invest in care, but over time, they believe it will set Scotland on a path towards transformative change. They state that a care marker would serve as a tool to measure and assess the amount of unpaid care work performed, providing valuable data to understand the magnitude of this issue. They believe that by making the invisible visible, a care marker would shed light on the unequal distribution of care responsibilities and help policymakers identify areas that require attention and support. I was interested in this ask, as I also believe if we could encompass a gender facet to this, we could see realistically how much of society women hold up for free. I know firsthand how sorely needed that insight is, and I hope the Scottish Government truly consider the message of this campaign and what it is trying to achieve. I believe we need to be willing to see the good, bad and ugly sides, not gloss over them, and face the reality of what is happening in Scotland for many to be able to hold ourselves to account and make real revolutionary change. Oxfam states that the Scotland That Cares campaign, at its core, seeks to put carers and the people we care for at the heart of the Scottish Government's vision for the country. They say there is a golden opportunity to do just that, with the Scottish Government currently reviewing Scotland's national outcomes. This doesn't mean that nothing's being done to support carers in Scotland. In fact, the support here is often better than in other parts of the UK. But it's clear that more progress is still very much needed, with the emotional and financial strain faced by too many carers still much too great. We need to make care count, to make it valued, to make it visible. We all want and need a caring society. Without carers, our country and economy would simply grind to a halt. Will you take some time to show that you care? That hash Scotland cares. You can find out more about the A Scotland That Cares campaign at www.ascotlandthatcares.com. a Scotland that cares dot org. All lowercase. This article was by Karen Adam.
The National News on Wednesday, the 7th of June. Compensation for small businesses on South Uist is not off the table. An article written by Laura Pollock. Mary McCallan has recommitted ministers to talks with South Uist businesses affected by summer sailing cuts, including the topic of compensation. Standing in for former Transport Minister Kevin Stewart, Net Zero and Just Transition Secretary Mary McCallan recommitted ministers to having conversations with businesses on South Uist affected by the CalMac disruption. Reports suggest up to one-third of the island's 2,000 people turned out for a demonstration as the last ferry until June the 30th left the harbour at Lough Boisdale this week. Labour MSP Rhoda Grant asked if the government will compensate businesses on South Uist which face losses as a result of the cancelled service, to which Ms McCallan said the penalty deductions paid by CalMac as a result of disruption should be reinvested in the ferry network. Pressed by Conservative Donald Cameron on the issue of compensation, the minister said it would not be off the table. It would be wrong of me to be as candid as I have about how much we understand the frustration of island communities and then to close myself off to having discussions about anything that communities would be calling for, she said. So I recommit ministers to having these conversations. I do believe that what islanders want most of all is for the Scottish Government and CalMac to focus on improving the service in the here and now and for the future, so that reliability on that service is not something that communities have to worry about on a daily basis. While Ms McCallan expressed the government's disappointment at the decision by CalMac, which has relocated the Lord of the Isles elsewhere due to issues on the network, and admitted islanders have lost confidence in the state-owned operator, Ms Grant said anger extends to ministers. This is not a problem with communications, it's a problem due to the lack of ferries, Ms Grant said. The blame for the lack of ferries sits squarely at the door of Ms McCallan's government. She must stop passing the buck because South Uist has lost confidence not in CalMac, but in the Scottish Government. Ms McCallan said, operational matters on the running of the ferry network, they are for CalMac, so it's only right that I reflect that in this Parliament. But I will not prevaricate on the point that pressure in our ferry network is as acute as it has been. Ministers empathise deeply with communities who have been affected. We understand their frustration. For our part, for what we are responsible for, we're working in the here and now to press CalMac on the prioritisation matrix on communications and on ensuring that disruption is as minimal as possible. The government is continuing its efforts to procure further vessels for the network, the minister added. CalMac Chief Executive Robbie Drummond said, we're extremely sorry to the community of South Uist for the disruption caused by the cancellation of Lough Boisdale services. We understand just how much the ferry service is depended upon by locals and by visitors. Additional sailings have been arranged across the Sound of Barra and the Little Minch so that customers can still access South Uist. We will reopen the Lough Boisdale service as soon as we possibly can. An article written by Laura Pollock. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 7th of June. Ian Blackford to step down as MP at the next election. An article written by Hamish Morrison. Ian Blackford, the former leader of the SNP at Westminster, will step down as an MP at the next election, he has confirmed. He served as the MP for Ross, Skye and Lochaber since 2015 and said he looked forward to playing my part from outside frontline politics when he leaves Westminster. Speculation had been mounting he would quit his seat, but he told The National as recently as last month he had not considered resigning. It comes after he was ousted as Westminster leader of the SNP late last year. Some MPs felt his style at Prime Minister's questions was too long-winded, and many prefer Stephen Flynn's snappier approach. After he was ejected as Westminster group leader, he was tasked by the SNP leadership to research and draw up plans for Scotland's industrial future. His Ross, Skye and Lochaber seat is thought to be a key Scottish target for the Lib Dems, hopeful to translate their recent wins in England across the border. The party has put up local businessman Angus MacDonald to win back the seat lost in 2015. The area was former Lib Dem leader Charles Kennedy's territory, and he had held the seat and its predecessors for more than 30 years. In a statement to the press, Mr. Blackford said, "My desire to see Scotland become an independent country and for our country and its people to achieve its full potential remains as strong as when I first entered politics decades ago. Although I will not be standing for the Westminster Parliament at the next election, I look forward to playing my part in the continuing campaign for Scottish independence and supporting our First Minister and the SNP as we go forward to the next election and beyond." Stephen Flynn praised his predecessor as a fierce opponent of the Conservatives during his time as the SNP group leader. He said, "During his time as SNP Westminster leader, Ian stood across the House of Commons from four Tory Prime Ministers and was a fierce opponent for every one of them, taking them on over Brexit, austerity cuts, Westminster attacks on devolution and their undemocratic attempts to deny Scotland's right to choose our own future." Mr. Flynn, the MP for Aberdeen South, added, "I know Ian will be sorely missed by his constituents and colleagues when he stands down as an MP, but I'm confident that he will have a key role in continuing the campaign for Scotland to become an independent country." Alex Cole-Hamilton, leader of the Scottish Lib Dems, said the race for the Ross, Skye and Lochaber seat was going to be a straight fight between his party and the SNP. The Edinburgh MSP added, "The SNP hasn't delivered for the West Highlands. Powers and budgets have been centralised to Holyrood, and there's been a complete dearth of infrastructure spends in the Highlands since the SNP came to power. The people have been deprived of effective representation there since they lost Charles Kennedy as their MP in 2015. At the next election, the choice in Ross, Skye and Lochaber will be clear. A fresh start with local Lib Dem Angus MacDonald, or more of the same with a Central Belt-centric SNP." An article written by Hamish Morrison. The National, on Wednesday, the 7th of June. Opinion: Douglas Ross's attack on drag queens shows the Tories' hypocrisy. The Real Scottish Politics, a column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. Douglas Ross has waded into the culture wars. The Scots Tory leader spoke out against a drag queen storytime event planned to be held in Elgin. Mr. Ross insisted that the event was totally inappropriate for young children because he apparently believes that the sight of someone cross-dressing is focusing on gender and sexual identity. "He's going to freak out when he learns about pantomime, isn't he? Oh no, he isn't. Oh yes, he is." Green MSP Maggie Chapman accused Mr. Ross of desperately scraping the bottom of the barrel for more culture war nonsense. "Drag as an art form is not inherently age inappropriate for children, any more than all stand-up comedy is inappropriate for children just because some performers swear and tell jokes about sex and adult relationships. Some drag performers are for adult audiences, others just put on a show in fabulous costumes that are appropriate for any age, although not apparently for someone as immature as Douglas Ross. In any case, children do not attend these events unaccompanied, they're typically taken to them by their parents. And it's for parents to decide what's appropriate for their own children, and not Douglas Ross. Remember, his party got its knickers in a twist over the planned named person scheme a few years ago, insisting it was intolerable state interference with family rights. Yet now here's Mr. Ross interfering with the rights of parents to decide for themselves what is appropriate for their children." Meanwhile, the academic Dr. John Robertson, who the BBC allegedly tried to get sacked in 2014 when he presented clear evidence of systematic pro-union bias in its reporting of the referendum, has carried out a new study comparing the framing of political stories by BBC Scotland with similar stories covered by BBC Wales. Unsurprisingly to any independent supporter who's kept a keen eye on how the media covers the SNP, the Scottish Government and the wider independence debate, he again discovered evidence of systematic bias in BBC Scotland's reporting. We're now at the point with BBC Scotland where it would have been truly surprising if Dr. Robertson had not found evidence of systematic bias. Dr. Robertson claimed it's a politicising of public services in Scotland that is not happening in Wales. Nowhere else in Europe would people think if there's something wrong in a hospital, you go straight to the government. He added, this is a very objective piece of evidence. A lot of research into media bias is very subjective, based on interpretation and so on. But objectively, BBC Wales did it by a ratio of 1-2 with BBC Scotland. The big difference, of course, is that Wales has a Labour government, which is committed to keeping Wales a part of the UK. And while there's certainly been a surge of interest in independence in Wales in recent years, support for independence remains very much in the minority in the country. The anti-independence parties and their supporters in the media do not fear any imminent threat from the Welsh independence movement or Plaid Cymru, the major pro-independence party in the country. In Scotland, by contrast, politics is dominated by the independence question. Support for independence often exceeds 50% in opinion polling, and so the anti-independence parties and their supporters in the media are very much concerned to keep a lid on support. Hence the relentless attacks on the SNP and the Scottish Government, while far bigger scandals involving the Tories and the UK Government pass with relatively little comment in the Scottish media. A column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. The National, on Wednesday, the 7th of June. Opinion. Far from helping farmers, Brexit has sold them out. A column written by Alan Smith. Farming is an issue close to my heart and is an area which deserves far more attention than it gets. Call it agriculture, only so many people are interested. Call it food security, call it land management, call it environmental protections, and all of a sudden you start to see that actually it affects all of us. So it was a pleasure to meet with representatives from Scotland's farming sector yesterday. The National Farmers Union of Scotland does a power of work advocating for the sector's interests across these islands, so it was good to see familiar faces. The common challenge facing farmers across these islands is Brexit. The Windsor framework has at least delivered on smoothing out the Northern Ireland Protocol. It is, though, a solution to a problem which should never have existed in the first place. Even then, issues remain as both the National Farmers Union of Scotland and the Ulster Farmers Union, whom I also met, were keen to stress. Although the ban on exporting Scottish seed potatoes to Northern Ireland has been lifted, livestock movements between both places remains in place. Traditionally, many dozens of pedigree cattle and sheep born in Northern Ireland were often sold, particularly at places such as United Auctions in my own constituency of Stirling. Post-Brexit, though, the added bureaucracy and regulations have meant that such trade has fallen off a cliff. If livestock is not sold within 15 days at an approved animal and plant health agency site, it cannot be brought back into the EU for 6 months. Naturally, this makes the cost of doing business untenable. Beyond livestock themselves, the lack of a veterinary, sanitary and phytosanitary agreement between the EU and the UK creates additional checks on goods between the island of Great Britain and EU and Northern Ireland. Such checks are required since there, the UK and the EU are no longer aligned on the regulatory standards for plants, animals, veterinary medicines and so forth. An agreement would remove these barriers and thereby give Scottish farmers access to the EU's single market once again. Instead, the UK remains stuck in the mud over what to do. Instead of helping our farming community, it's sold them out with trade deals such as the Australia and New Zealand agreements, which have recently come into force. Scottish food products are high quality and amongst the best in the world. However, how can you expect them to compete with large-scale imports after the UK once again sacrificed farming interests for a Brexit PR win? All this Brexit bureaucracy and undermining of our food sector goes a long way towards explaining the difficulties facing Scottish farmers and the increase in food prices that we're all suffering from. Food inflation remains stubbornly high, with the latest figures from the British Retail Consortium putting it at 15.4%, only a small drop from April's record 15.7%. Meanwhile, the Office for National Statistics notes that this year has seen food price inflation at the highest rate in 45 years. Of course, there are mitigating circumstances, such as the war in Ukraine and the impact of the COVID pandemic. However, only the UK has chosen to leave the EU and the benefits it provided. Before Brexit, farmers could attract seasonal workers from across the EU to plant and pick their crops. Now, complex visa processes and the fall in the pound mean that for many it is no longer profitable to come here for work. Under the EU's Common Agricultural Policy, farmers received multi-annual payments over a seven-year framework. In England, DEFRA has limited to a single national payment, and whereas Scottish produce could be sold in Paris, Milan or Warsaw with minimum fuss, now it requires masses of paperwork and an army of lawyers, accountants and vets to do so. And all these issues are before we, the UK, start its own import checks. I will always stand up for Scotland's farmers, and it's clear that Scotland's best future is back in the EU. Unlike the Brexiteers, we know what independence back in the EU will look like, having been a member for nearly 50 years. Working with our European friends across the continent as the newest member of the single market, we can help ensure that Scotland's farmers always get the best deal for their products. A column written by Alan Smith. The National News on Wednesday, the 7th of June. ScotRail to crack down on fare dodgers. An article written by Steph Braun. ScotRail has announced a crackdown on people who intentionally attempt to avoid paying the correct fare for their journey. The train operator will hire 42 revenue protection officers to curb ticket fraud, which costs it around £2 million per year. It's also introduced new ticket validation machines, which can be found at Edinburgh Waverley, Croy, Paisley Canal and in Glasgow's Central, Queen Street, High Street and Rutherglen stations. The devices read both mobile and barcoded tickets at ticket gates before allowing passengers through. They will flag up tickets that are not valid for a particular journey. They can also detect whether a passenger has travelled a longer distance than they claim. For instance, a passenger may claim to have only travelled from Edinburgh Haymarket to Waverley, when in fact they may have boarded in Glasgow. The devices can even check if the customer is travelling from a station that is staffed, where they could have bought a ticket but chose not to. Revenue protection officers will check tickets that are flagged by the devices. If customers are caught intentionally using an invalid ticket, their details will be taken and they will be charged the correct fare. For more serious cases, they may face being investigated by the British Transport Police. ScotRail has encouraged passengers to purchase tickets before boarding a train, which can be done at stations, ticket offices or online. Phil Campbell, ScotRail Head of Customer Operations, said, "Tackling ticket fraud has always been a priority for ScotRail. It's a small minority of passengers who deliberately try to avoid paying the proper fare, but it's honest, fare-paying passengers who bear the burden of lost investment in Scotland's railway." The 42 new revenue protection officers will be deployed around the rail network, working from the first trains to the last. Those roles will really help support frontline colleagues with ticket irregularity, fraud and any difficult situations. We're determined to drive down ticketless travel, making the rail network a safer and more secure environment for customers and colleagues alike. An article written by Steph Braun. The National News on Wednesday, the 7th of June. Volunteers invited to join clinical trials for a new contraceptive. An article written by Jane McLeod. Women living in Lothian and in Ayrshire are being invited to take part in trials to test the effectiveness of a new six-monthly contraceptive injection, which could halve the number of times they need to see a medic each year. Medics currently have to administer the contraceptive injection four times a year, but if the University of Edinburgh study proves successful, those who use the new jab would only need to arrange an appointment twice a year. The study, which is being carried out across three other countries, requires around 750 volunteers aged between 18 and 35 and will see the women injected with depometrohydroxyprogesterone acetate, or DMPA, under their skin every 6 months. The DMPA injection contains the hormone progesterone, which prevents pregnancy by stopping the release of eggs from the ovaries and thickening the cervical mucus to make it harder for sperm to reach the womb. Researchers say the new method of contraception could be more effective, as having to inject less frequently should reduce the chances of pregnancy due to missed or late medical appointments. Sharon Cameron, an NHS consultant gynaecologist and honorary professor at the MRC Centre for Reproductive Health, said, "This trial of a new contraceptive method, designed to be taken twice a year rather than the current four times a year, could potentially offer meaningful benefits to many women around the world who are taking birth control. As it's injected under the skin instead of into a muscle, DMPA will last twice as long in the body, thereby offering a more convenient option and potentially fewer side effects compared to the current dosage regimen." An article written by Jane McLeod.
From the National, Thursday the 8th of June 2023, from the news section, ScotRail, RMT members accept pay offer, by James Walker. The biggest rail workers' union has accepted a pay offer from ScotRail. The Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, RMT, said its members will receive a 5% basic uplift, with the lowest paid receiving as much as an 8% increase. The pay deal was overwhelmingly endorsed by ScotRail members in a referendum. RMT General Secretary Mick Lynch said, "This was a tough negotiation and our members have voted to accept this modest pay deal. We have managed to negotiate this deal like many others on the railways, including in Wales, the English regions, and now Scotland, where the Department for Transport has a controlling mandate for 14 train operators. RMT has had a year-long dispute with multiple strikes. ScotRail members have benefited from annual pay rises and extra value added to their overall pay packages. Unlike RMT members on 14 rail operators, some of whom have not had a pay rise in 4 years." And that report was by James Walker. From the National, Thursday the 8th of June 2023, from the Politics section. Exclusive. What did Ian Blackford really think of the Tory PMs he faced? By Steph Braun. Ian Blackford should really only have faced one or potentially two Prime Ministers in his 5.5 years as SNP Westminster leader. But over the period, he stood across from no less than four Tory PMs in the House of Commons, as British politics was sent into turmoil, initially by Brexit, and then by the man who got it done, before parties at number 10 during lockdown led to his demise, and that of the Tory party as a whole. After Blackford announced he would not be running for the election again earlier this week, the National's Holyrood Weekly podcast asked him to lay down exactly what he thought of Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. Theresa May. Blackford was first faced with the former Home Secretary May, who became a PM in 2016 after David Cameron resigned following the Brexit referendum. He described May as a woman of few words when it came to answering his questions at PMQs every Wednesday. But he did also say she was understanding of everyone's role in the Commons and, particularly in hindsight following the premiership of Johnson, he admitted she at least operated with proper protocols. He told the podcast, "What I learned with Theresa was that she probably had about five answers to any question I was going to ask, and the answer had got nothing to do with the question that I asked. But the one thing I would also say about Theresa is that she understood we all had a job to do, and the protocols worked quite well. Things that you needed to know were told on a need-to-know basis, sharing of national security information, and so on. You needed that to do the job. If I think back to things like the Salisbury Skripal incident, that was a situation where you were on the same side, and I make no apology for that, because that was an attack on somebody in the UK by agents of the Russian state. So why would you not stand together in opposing that? But you need to have all the information to be able to form that judgment, so those things worked quite well." Boris Johnson. What Blackford then observed was that during the Johnson era, protocols had been kept in the loop about need-to-know issues went out the window. Despite Johnson's claims they were pals, Blackford said he had no relationship with him, and still to this day described him as a man not fit for public office. He told Holyrood Weekly of a time that summed up just how much disrespect Johnson showed for the SNP. The Ross, Skye and Lochaber MP said, "What I really struggled with that man, Johnson, that followed me, was all that went out the window, respect for protocols. There was no relationship. I got irritated with him when he tried to suggest he and I were pals. We had no relationship. I remember one occasion when he responded, or he led for the government in a debate about cutting international aid, and it wasn't on the order paper. It was on the order paper as a government speaker to be announced. They didn't even tell us he was going to be speaking. The first we knew was when he stood up in the chamber, and so I couldn't have responded to him because the rules wouldn't allow you to do it, because you had to be there at the start. That was the kind of disrespect he showed, not just to us, but to others too. I have to say that was a man that was so unsuited to public office, never mind being Prime Minister." Liz Truss: "Given she was only in office for fewer than 6 weeks, during some of which Parliament was suspended due to the Queen's death, you can count on one hand the amount of times Blackford faced off with Truss. He didn't have much to say about her personal performances at PMQs, naturally, as there were hardly enough moments on which to form an opinion. The dominant memory from that time for Blackford was the mini-budget and quasi-Quartings accompanying statement, which sent mortgage rates rocketing and the pound plummeting." Blackford said, "Liz Truss, how could they possibly have chosen someone worse than Boris Johnson? But they did it. I think the defining moment of her is not so much of her own performances, but the financial statement from quasi-Quartering, which was a gobsmacking moment, and the damage that was done as a consequence of that." Rishi Sunak: "Before handing over the SNP Westminster leader reins to Stephen Flynn, Blackford faced Sunak on a number of occasions and has since concluded his politics is repugnant. He criticised his approach to migration and his efforts to stop people arriving on small boats from claiming asylum in the UK. Summing up his thoughts on Sunak, Blackford said, "I think his politics is pretty repugnant, and I actually think he's more right-wing than people think. The whole thing about the small boats is a very good example of that. Having said that, he doesn't have the personality of a Boris Johnson or a Liz Truss, and at the very least we can be thankful for that." The Holyrood Weekly podcast will be available on the National's website, Spotify and the Omni streaming platform each Friday. And that article was written by Steph Braun. From the National, Thursday the 8th of June 2023, from the comments section, World Ocean Day, despite huge marine wealth, Scotland cannot act. By Marie Gojon, Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, Land Reform and Islands. Scotland's seas are nearly six times larger than the land area of Scotland and provide our nation with huge potential. So it's fitting that today, on World Ocean Day, we celebrate all that they contribute to our economic, environmental and social well-being. Every day, people go to work in often challenging, occasionally dangerous conditions in our seas to bring us food and energy, to create knowledge of a better marine environment, to take us closer to the abundant flora and fauna that exists in our waters, some of which is unique to Scotland. I thank them all for all that they do, not just on World Ocean Day, but every day. By using our powers where we can, devolution has delivered tangible economic, social and environmental benefits for our nation, and especially our island and coastal communities. Our seafood sector accounted for 60% of Scotland's food exports in 2021, and we have the third largest salmon aquaculture sector in the world, with 75% of the sector supply chain based here in Scotland, creating additional jobs and businesses. We also have a strong track record in protecting our marine environment, with 37% of our seas already designated as marine protected areas, and we are taking a global leadership role in blue carbon research and knowledge exchange. However, we know that our marine environment and natural resources are under pressure like never before. The twin threats of climate change and biodiversity loss are impacting on the health of our oceans worldwide, a fact also being acknowledged today. I know that Scotland's fishing and seafood industry values a healthy marine environment as much as the Scottish Government does. More than any of us, They understand the importance of protecting and enhancing our marine environment, not least for the benefit of future generations. And today, I want to assure our fishing industry that there will continue to be a space for fishing to operate in Scotland's waters in a sustainable and responsible way, now and in the future. Our seas are also under threat in a political sense. Westminster has shown itself to be utterly dismissive of Scotland's unique needs and willing to take actions that hurt our blue economy. Scotland, our marine industries and island and coastal communities especially, has been harmed by Brexit through trade barriers, reduced access to labour and, for some, fewer fishing opportunities than under the Common Fisheries Policy. That Scotland, with almost two-thirds of the UK's exclusive economic zone, the area of the sea which coastal countries have exclusive sovereign rights and duties, cannot negotiate for its own interests, diminishes our influence in Europe and the world. We cannot afford to be bystanders, hoping that others will take the right decisions for us, watching on as our marine interests and coastal communities are put at risk. With independence, Scotland would be able to apply to join the EU, giving our seafood exporters unrestricted access to the world's biggest single market and allowing businesses, communities and our science sector to once again benefit from freedom of movement within the EU. Independence would allow us to champion Scotland's interests at the heart of the EU, and, based on the size and strength of our marine sector, we could expect to have significant influence. We would be able to negotiate a fair share of funding to invest in our seafood industry, our coastal communities, and our marine science sector, prioritising our marine interests ahead of watching them being diluted by wider UK objectives. Independence would give us a voice on the world stage and the ability to join international bodies in our own right, enabling us to work with like-minded nations to tackle shared challenges that do not respect national boundaries. To meet the challenges we face, Scotland must have a voice in the issues and laws that affect our communities. Decisions should be made by those with the greatest stake in them and those who will be most affected by them, the people of Scotland. Scotland is a proud marine and maritime nation. Our seas, coasts and islands have shaped our identity, our culture and our way of life. Our blue economy continues to underpin our coastal and island communities. The opportunities for Scotland's marine sector are great, but we can only fully realise that potential with the full powers of independence. In an article by Marie Gaujon, who is the Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, Land Reform and Islands.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hear and Review. Tell your friends about our service.